I'm Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business, happy to present the latest edition of our TV podcast, The Spinoff. Now here's host Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider, and this is The Spinoff. Happy New Year, everyone. We're back for the January 2014 edition of The Spinoff. I'm Michael Schneider, the Los Angeles bureau chief of TV Guide magazine, and I'm here in the same room. Believe it or not, we're all here together with Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. Hey, Joe, is that really you? Am I poking you right now?
Yeah, shalom, Mike. I am here.
And tackling the new year with style, it is AJ Marischal of Variety. Hey, AJ, happy new year.
For the record, he was not physically poking Joe.
This is the magic of the podcast. So we are here at our first remote taping of the podcast. This is the TV Critics Association gathering at the Langham Hotel in Pasadena, California. And we're going to get to talk a little bit about the TCA Press Tour, what it is and why we're here in just a minute. But also on the docket today, as pilot season gets underway, we'll discuss why the networks are still developing shows the old-fashioned way. And we'll also dig deep on the recent controversy behind Duck Dynasty. All right, so first topic, the Television Critics Association Press Tour. So twice a year, the reporters who cover TV, including all of us here in the room, we sit in a chilly hotel ballroom for several weeks. The broadcast and cable executives, they come out, they tout their new TV series, and it's pretty valuable. You know, we get to talk to execs, producers, talent, but these days, a lot of reporters are on their laptops. They're tweeting, they're snarking on their blogs. They're not really paying quite the attention that they used to. And the quality of some of the press conferences, I would argue, has gone down as writers ask some really inane questions and others just aren't even paying attention to what's going on in the room. So, Joe, I've gone to maybe about 40 of these now. You've gone to more than I have. What do you make? I mean, we've seen the evolution of the TV Critics Association press tour. Is it still worth it? You're here. You came out to attend this year.
You know, I think it depends upon what the networks expect from these press tours. You know, it used to be back in the day before back in the 90s.
Old
the
man
80s.
Italian.
Basically, reporters came to press tour and they were sort of like squirrels gathering nuts for the winter. They would come out and they would do news conferences and conduct interviews. And those interviews would not see the light of day for a couple weeks or months even until the shows premiered. And it was great. Basically, it was a great way for reporters and sources and entertainers slash producers, writers, actors to get together and to sort of talk about the new season. And it was a great thing for the networks because it provided all sorts of free publicity. Right now, I don't know. Right now, it's like this mega tweet-a-thon. It's this event that everyone feels they have to go to and make a big deal out of, but it all disappears into the ether after about 5 seconds. Nobody remembers anything. Do networks really want to keep doing this? I don't know. On one hand, it's good because it puts network TV and cable TV at the center of attention.
Well, and one of the things I think I still like about the TCA is the TV industry is one of the few industries where the presidents, the heads of the networks, the heads of these corporations are forced to meet with the press every 6 months.
And have a dialogue.
It's a press conference that you don't see in the auto industry or even in the movie industry. But yet TV, we require these network presidents to show up every 6 months and sort of atone for their actions, explain what they've done. And some years they have great stories to tell. Some years they have to show up and say, listen, our fall tanked and this is why it didn't work. And they have to be honest with us. And AJ, since you're relatively newer to this whole dog and pony show, what do you make of this?
Well, my first TCA was, this is my fourth. And during my first, I remember walking in and thinking, this is like trying to find a seat on your first day at a new high school. Everyone knew each other, and there was definitely a certain social vibe to it of all these journalists that go back many years like you two do. Some of the rules struck me as kind of strange. You're not allowed to clap, and a lot of the talent sometimes doesn't know that you're not allowed to clap. So I actually met with some MTV talent yesterday, and they were like, why was the room so dead? But it's not just the clapping, the lack of clapping that makes the room dead. It is really this whole, the Twitterfication of TCA that to me gets out of control in a way, because there are benefits to it. I see TCA hashtag TCA14 trending nationally yesterday on Twitter. And a lot of fans of upcoming TV shows will follow it. Joe, you look like you want to chime
in
on this.
Well, the problem with the tweeting, I think, is that it's the comic-conification of press tour, right? I mean, it becomes this big event as opposed to a place for everyone to get together and learn about TV shows. It's about this brief shining moment where everything goes out in the ether and the internet, and it becomes a little bit too much for my taste, like a fanboy thing. Comic-Con is great.
It's also a kind of a one-upsmanship in terms of the snark on Twitter among all these journalists. And to me, sometimes it makes me kind of sad to see just how snarky people will get to their tens of thousands of followers for these people that are really just on stage doing their jobs. You know, there's a sense almost of like entitlement to be snarky, to say rude things online about people who are on stage, because it becomes this sense of like kind of a volley back and forth of entertainment between journalists.
Well, and that's when the networks start to really question, why are we still doing this? You know, the reporters aren't really even paying attention. They're too busy out joking each other. And sometimes it can get kind of nasty. But on the flip side, I would argue that one of the reasons why TCA, the press tour, is still valuable to the networks is every once in a while there's a gem of a show that might have otherwise been lost, but for one reason or another, maybe it's an entertaining showrunner, maybe it's a star that sort of captures the attention of the crowd, but it wins over this crowd, and suddenly these critics are rooting for that show. This summer, it was ABC's Trophy Wife, which probably would have
been absolutely nothing for the ratings.
Well, but the buzz is the only thing that's saving that show right now. Otherwise,
I would argue that buzz would be there even without TCA. I think critics can form buzz. The thing is, Twitter is TCA year-round now.
Oh, Joe just dropped a bomb.
I got deep.
but to some degree, you're right. And the access now that everyone gets has changed dramatically from back in the day when reporters, critics from across the new country were, first of all, working for newspapers. But the only access they got was when they came to TCA.
Right. But, and you know, the thing is now there's such a different collection of people who come to the TV Critics Association press tour. It used to be people from 75 to 100 major newspapers across the country and a smattering of radio stations. Now there are a lot of online outlets, and you know, it's the democratization. I work for an online outlet and nothing wrong with it, but it's the democratization of TCA in that you've got people with a whole bunch of different needs,
exactly,
including some whose only need is to get people to click on their stories right this minute. And that leads to somebody asking a provocative question of Lena Dunham, and it becomes a giant scandal because somebody needs to get that attention.
Well, there you go. Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to The Spinoff, the monthly TV podcast from KCRW's The Business. I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine, here with AJ Marischal of Variety and Joe Adalian of Vulture.com. So, guys, let's talk about pilots. It's that time of year again. Over the next few weeks, broadcast networks are going to be greenlighting their comedy and drama pilots for next year. Then they cast them. Then they shoot them. Then eventually in May, they decide which ones are actually going to go on the air. It pretty much is remained the same pilot season over the years, even though the industry is changing, even though the way people consume television is changing. And cable does pilots very differently. There is no pilot season in basic cable or at HBO or FX or AMC. AMC likes to point out that every single one of the pilots they've shot has eventually turned into a series. FX, it's kind of the same way.
Which is a real vote of confidence for their development department. It means that the scripts that they're developing and ordering pilots for, they really have taste for their network.
Now, or it becomes Low Winter Sun, anyway.
And on the... that's a whole separate conversation.
Sorry, AMC. I love you.
On the flip side, the networks every year they pick up the ballpark around 10 comedies and 10 dramas each, and those pilots could cost upwards of $5-7 million each. So they spend a lot of money on pilot season every year, even though the majority of those pilots will never actually make it to series. So, AJ, is it worth it, and why are they still doing it this way?
Well, it's a really costly, risk-averse model, is the best way that I can put it. Those pilots are expensive to make, but at the same time, this is an opportunity for a network to see what is the chemistry of this cast. Are these actors working in these roles? Do we like this given the tone of our network? You know, they're getting a sampling of what a giant series could be, which is a serious investment to be doing, ordering something to series. But the pilot itself, to me, is very creatively constraining, and sometimes as a business model, it's very constraining. In terms of the writers, TV writers, they have to jam a lot of information into the pilot so that networks can get get their head around where this series would be going. And as opposed to having a beautifully crafted first episode that then leads into a second, and we're having the plot move in an organic way. And, you know, in terms of people who are covering this business, it's a whole lot of horsepower for not a lot of giving back in terms of if you're covering a lot of pilot orders and you're never hearing about them again.
Right. And it's the whole thing is, to me, hopelessly wrongheaded and outdated. And look, networks like to say there's a lot of great reasons to do a pilot. You get to see this, you get to do that. Or it's like R&D, they'll say. It's no different than the car industry, who spends millions of dollars developing test cars that never actually get onto the road. But you know what? I think we're past the age where making a TV show is the same as making a car. And I think, to me, the quote of the year in 2013 came from Jenji Cohen, who's the creator of the incredible Orange is the New Black on Netflix.
Wait, do you want a drum roll before you reveal the quote of the year?
Yeah, that's thank you. It's a paraphrase. But basically, she told the Wall Street Journal the reason she loved doing Orange is the New Black for Netflix was because she didn't have to do a pilot. And she said, I don't want to have to do a sales tool, which is what pilots are. I want to do a TV show. And I think increasingly that's a better way to go. And I think you're seeing the broadcast networks, some of them at least, admit that.
Of course, on the flip side, Joe, I can count on one hand the number of shows that have actually been picked up to series without a pilot that have been successful. I mean, what do you make of, you know, direct-to-series?
Well, Under the Dome was direct-to-series, and it did pretty well. You know, I think the problem here is that the networks are still ingrained in doing things the old-fashioned way, but it is changing. I mean, I think we've talked about this on past podcasts. Fox has dramatically shook up the way it does stuff this year. I mean, it seems like they've had more series orders than pilot orders. I'm not paying as close attention as I once did.
Well, they're doing a lot of these limited series.
The limited series, they're changing it. You know, the thing is, I think they are finding the right talent, the right ideas, and they're saying, go.
They're
make
trusting
a TV show.
Them.
They're trusting Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, who have two projects that are going straight to series. They're trusting, Fox is trusting a whole bunch of people. But it's a better way to invest in the future.
But Joe, at the same time, the majority of direct-to-series orders that we've seen at the networks through the years have just not worked out.
The majority
Michael J. Fox this year was a show that was picked up 22
episodes still made
on the air.
But yeah, that was about giving a star a big order and winning a battle for his services.
Well,
that's
not what the Tina Fey order is?
Tina Fey thing is well, we'll see. But I think in her case, at least it'll allow it more time to sort of find its voice, as opposed to having to sort of write a pilot that gets people wowed. You know, the thing is, look, you still need to have something built into the process where you do an episode and you take a break and you say, let's see where this is. That's fine. You know, people like Kevin Reilly are all for that, because you want to be able to sort of say, all right, let's build in some backstops here so we can make changes in case something goes wrong. But much better to say, we're going to create a TV show and not a sales tool. There's a lot of money and effort. And it also, the other thing is, guys, is it puts the networks, not just reporters, but networks on this sort of treadmill where they're rushing to do the same cycle over and over and over again. We got to do this many. We got to do this now. We got to get all the same people cast in the course of 2 months.
Why don't they just act more like cable networks?
I think they're starting to. I think it's a transition process. I think Fox is starting it. You'll see it, I think, over the next 5 to 10 years. I think the pilot process as we know it will probably die. Mark my words, pilot season as we know it will not exist in five years.
I think you bring up a very good point there, in that, you know, you have executives at these networks who, you know, they're people. And at the end of the day, there are only so many hours in the day. And, you know, when you have 20 pilots, 10 comedy, 10 drama, you can't give the sort of detailed care that maybe cable networks that only have maybe two pilots at once can really focus on, just making those two shows, those two pilots, as damn near perfect as possible. When you've got 10 comedies you're in charge of, or 10 dramas in charge of, things are going to fall through the cracks. Some of those are going to be better than others. At some point, it just doesn't make any sense anymore.
I have friends who are TV writers, and I know what a pain in the ass writing pilots can be in order to impress networks, because again, you're needing to cram so much information about characters and plot
into
one.
Well, but I think you need pilots. Let's not confuse the issue here. You need pilots because you do need to sort of, you know, craft this show and
really
cast it properly. But direct to series is a whole different beast, and we're seeing more direct to series now. Some work, some are great, but
what I'm saying is that the creative potential of a direct to series order is vastly greater than a pilot order, because again, you're not having to overload your first episode with information. Like the Carrie Diaries pilot for me was a painful to watch because they were putting so many different plot points in it for them to then follow through on over the rest of its season order.
Right, because in case it's not clear to people who are listening, you probably got this, but you know the creators make these pilots to be judged by network executives over the course of 2 weeks in April and May, and it'll determine whether or not the pilot becomes a show. As opposed to just sort of simply trying to create the best product, they have to sort of put out there, and they have to be like a stripper going out there and sort of showing off her wares or his wares. And it's just no way to make television. And I think it was a fine system when, for so many decades, network television, commercial television was basically a marketing tool. It was a marketing tool for advertisers. TV shows,
well,
creators.
Well, Joe, it's still a marketing tool for advertisers.
It is, absolutely. But now, you know, advertisers are becoming in some ways a little bit less important to the process because now the money is being made through Netflix. The money is being made through international. The money is being made through other auxiliary revenues. So they're a little bit less influential. And yes, of course, advertisers are still in control and it only that impacts what you can have. I just feel it has to change. And I think you're seeing Fox and NBC change it. And mark my words, it's going to keep changing.
Yeah. Well, I think you're going to see another year this year where there's going to be this crunch because you have all the networks doing their pilots. And at the same time, you have the Netflixes of the world. You have new channels like WGN America doing their shows as well. And there's just, at some point, there is a finite amount of talent.
Right.
And finding actors. The majority of great actors.
You need
actors
to go out
probably,
in LA more. There is not.
Are they great actors, though?
I don't think the problem.
Trust me, there are plenty of actors in LA.
That's what I'm saying.
There's a finite number of great actors.
Right. I don't think the problem, Mike, is that there aren't enough actors or enough. There are too many TV shows. There's too much product being made. It needs to be a switch over to making TV shows. And I know that sounds all high and mighty, but look how much time and energy and ABC put into making Killer Women or The Assets. They go on the air, they premiere to a couple million people. Horrible demographics. They're going to be gone. Assets was gone after 2 weeks. Killer Woman will probably be gone after two or three. What's the point? When it's so easy to fail now, I think that's what's going to make networks change.
So we're going to take a short break now. And when we come back, we'll talk about what the quack happened to Duck Dynasty.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more. All in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're back. It's the spinoff from KCRW's The Business. I'm Michael Schneider here with Joe Adalian and AJ Marischal. So I want to take a moment to let everyone know where they can find the spinoff. If you listen to our mothership, KCRW's The Business, you can automatically get episodes of the spinoff each month through that feed. And now you can also podcast a spinoff separately through wherever you download podcasts. So there you go, the spinoff. We are everywhere, guys.
So we're everywhere you want to be.
Let's talk Duck Dynasty. So if you're out of the country during the holidays, that's the only way you didn't hear about this controversy.
Not true. Definitely there were TV publicists who heard about this on the beaches of exotic islands.
Well, then it was everywhere.
They covered in Le Figaro.
But let's remind everyone, just in case you wanted to forget and maybe wanted to start off 2014 without remembering what happened.
Blocked it from
your memory. Yeah, so Phil Robertson, who's the patriarch of the clan on A&E's Duck Dynasty, he made a few slightly racist comments about gays and African Americans in a GQ interview. And so then A&E raced to put Robertson on what they called a hiatus, but of course they weren't shooting the show at the time.
Filming hiatus.
Yes, a filming hiatus. But then that caused a whole different stir, especially in the right-wing media. And A&E was accused of muffling Mr. Robertson and First Amendment questions and religious beliefs and all that stuff was sort of thrown around as well. So then A&E took Robertson off of double secret probation and promised to run a series of PSAs, public service announcements, and do a few other things to sort of smooth things over. So now season 5 of Duck Dynasty premieres on January 15, right around the corner. So actually by the time you're listening to this, we'll actually know whether or not the controversy actually paid off in bigger ratings or if it had really any impact on the show. So who are we kidding, AJ? This is going to be huge, right? I mean, the ratings are going to be goosed, pun intended.
I really don't think that it's going to have that much of an impact on the ratings,
no?
But watch me eat my words when the ratings come out. I mean, this show is already performing gangbusters on A&E. It's kind of at the point where could it get any better? Are we starting to reach the decline of the Duck Dynasty trend? So I don't think that we'll see a really big move of the needle when it comes to ratings after the Duck Dynasty controversy. What was fascinating to watch for me, when I was one of the first people out with this story, and the views that you got online with this were insane because of what I'm going to call the Drudge effect, where there were a lot of like right-wing internet users and fundamentalist Christians who used this essentially as a lightning rod to turn it into a red state versus blue state issue, which then in turn made it a hot button issue for cable news networks. Well, within 24 hours, I had two or three cable news shows. Yeah, they wanted talking heads on it, especially during the slow news period of the holidays. So
right, there are only so many times you can talk about the war on Christmas.
Yeah,
so this was another hot topic.
I'm pretty used to seeing, you know, such and such star says controversial remark. We saw it happen with Alec Baldwin. We've seen it happen with a lot of other celebrities who show up on TMZ. But this really became a national phenomenon, was trending on Twitter for days, to me, because it really embodied that whole red state versus blue state issue. This whole idea of freedoms of speech. Are we suffocating people who are expressing their religious beliefs in the press, even if they are becoming quote unquote outdated compared to the beliefs of the majority of Americans? So it became bigger than Duck Dynasty. It became bigger than A&E. And that's why the controversy was so huge.
Joe, how should A&E have handled this? Or do you think they handled it the best they could?
You know, Mike, I guess A&E handled it fine. I have to say, the bigger picture for me is what's more interesting about this whole Duck Dynasty thing, which is we've become there's an outrage industry now that has taken root in this country. And look, I make a difference.
That's why, by the way, A&E probably should have known this, though. We know there's an outrage industry out there. We know there's talk radio.
What A&E should have known? What I mean, yeah, right. But the thing is, people got outraged on the left over what he said. Then people got outraged on the right. We're all outraged at everybody. Here's the thing: I propose a different set of standards. Politicians are one thing. People who are elected, people who are representatives in Congress or in the White House or wherever, state houses. Fine, go to town on people when they say, you know, legitimate rape or something horrible like that. You know, those sorts of controversies are fine.
A&E folks wish that had happened just maybe 2 weeks earlier.
Sure, but that's a scandal. So that's one thing. But when it comes to our celebrities, you know, this is the problem with Twitter. This is the problem with too many news outlets and too many media outlets. Is we all feed on each other and this culture and industry of outrage, and it's ridiculous. It's Melissa Harris Perry and her friends have a joke over something that they might have said on a Sunday morning show that nobody's watching, and we have to get outraged for several days. The Duck Dynasty people give an interview to a magazine, and we all have to get outraged for a few days. People say and do stupid things. I don't condone for a second anything that guy said, okay? I don't watch Duck Dynasty. Things are awful. It makes me roll my eyes. But at the end of the day, if they're not being said on TV, and that I think is a key thing, we all just need to move on. We need to report it, and we need to move on, and we need to stop feeding this culture. They're feeding this whole idea that everything has to give everyone fits and starts, and everyone has to apologize or not apologize or be punished or not punished. You know, did A&E overreact? Yes, they did, probably, but they overreacted from the best instincts. I get why they're upset, and they had every right to, because he's their employee. But at the same time, we all just have spent way too much time thinking about all of this stuff. And yes, that may make me
it's really indicative of the clickbait culture of the internet and the shouting, the crossfire culture of cable news networks. Because, you know, when a story like the Duck Dynasty controversy comes up, web editors across America know this is going to be huge. We're going to get insane website viewership this week. We're going to break our records and whatnot. We need to be pumping out more content. So it's this need to continue the clickbait culture and to increase the web traffic. And that, I mean, I can't even say that I'm above that. I'm not. You know, we all work at publications that have online outlets. And we all, I think, have graced the cable news airwaves at one point or another. But, you know, it's that Joe apparently knows.
Well, sorry.
Well, that's why there are new rules. If you're doing corporate communication, communications. If you're a conglomerate, you have to be aware of this now. And they keep sticking their feet in the culture wars inadvertently, not realizing that they're just going to create a new Drudge headline. I mean, we saw it last summer when NBC announced a Hillary Clinton miniseries. Somehow they didn't realize that that was just going to create a frenzy
on
both sides.
Is this now the world we have to live in, where no one can make a creative choice to do a Hillary Clinton miniseries, where you can't see a nice family show about these guys hunting ducks or whatever it is they do on Duck Dynasty? Now, look, I don't like his opinions, but I don't care. He's not making policy. He's
right.
not he's, saying it on TV.
He's your crazy uncle.
A&E is not giving – if A&E were giving him a form to do this, then I might have a problem with my cable bill being used to pay this. I do think there have to be some standards, I guess, but at the same time, I just feel we're all just making too much of everything. And I think there needs to be a detente on both the left and right. We all will agree. We'll report these things when they happen. Each will roll our eyes, depending upon what our point of view is, and say, idiot. But we'll take to Twitter and we'll get it out of us, and then we'll move on. There should be a 24-hour statute of limitations on all this stuff. Everyone gets out all their rage, all their drudge, all their clicks, and then move on. It's ridiculous.
Well, Joe, if you were the mayor of journalism, maybe that would happen. But come on. This is so unrealistic.
I'm running in November. Please vote for me.
But this is the new
reality.
It's
not just us, though. I mean, there were hundreds upon hundreds, thousands even, comments from people who, are just sitting on Facebook all day and looking for something to complain about.
That's
really nasty.
And that's the problem. The world of online comments has become our culture.
This was my first time of learning to, quote, not read the comments section was the Duck Dynasty stuff, because
never read the comments.
It was phenomenal, the kind of stuff that was being said towards me as a journalist, me as a person and whatnot, is next level.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I think the only solution to some of this stuff is you got to go more passive aggressive. You can't put Phil Roberts in the corner, but you can kind of shame him instead. You can say, listen, if it were A&E, we disagree what Phil Robertson had to say, and we're going to donate money on his behalf, in his name, to certain charities that support tolerance, and we invite him to do the same.
Right,
and you sort of force him to, it's back on him. Now, that's passive aggressive. But
you wrote a great column about this, Mike, on Franklin Avenue on your side, and I think it's 100% right. I think that's actually a way out of this, which is we need to officially stop caring as much. We can, as people, be outraged if we want, but I think these TV networks, including MSNBC or CNN, I don't care what Martin Bashir said about Sarah Palin. I don't care, someone on Fox News says about someone else, about the president on a regular basis. It needs to stop.
I have a question for you guys, because one of the broader issues that came up with the Duck Dynasty debacle is A&E knew the thought that A&E knew what it was getting itself into when they hired this family to be on their airwaves. They knew that they were fundamentalist Christians. They knew that they were out in the Bible thumping
right,
world
but
of the
that
South.
Wasn't what the show was about.
Correct.
So it didn't matter what they personally felt. That's not what
the
show is.
Well, the question is then, should A&E be held responsible, and is it right for them to be putting somebody on hiatus when they knew the entire time that they not only held these beliefs, but also were saying them in public forums?
But AJ, because they've had conversations with Phil Robertson, they've said, listen, we know this is what you believe, but please don't say it.
I agree with you.
Listen, you now have a show on a major network that's a big hit, and it is in your best interest not to do interviews and share this. You can have your personal feeling, but
it's the incredibly sticky world of having your brand be your actual real life personality in reality TV.
How much do you show? Andy isn't selling his personal views.
Yeah.
Well, they are, to an degree. But the thing is, I think Andy had every right to put him on non-hiatus, because let's face it, it was a joke. If they want to, sure, because he has a contract with them and they're his boss. And the whole fear over how dare they and protect the First Amendment was just nonsense. Should they have? No, they shouldn't have, because we saw what happened. And maybe this will end up being, dare I say it, a teachable moment for the TV industry, that they will learn in the future how to deal with this stuff. Deal with it the way that Mike Schneider suggested. Be passive aggressive. Say, put out a press release that says, really? And then move on.
Passive-aggressive 2014. That's the resolution.
Mike?
Well, now we're at the point in the show where we're going to go around the room, and each of us are going to download the story that's on top of mind this month. So, AJ, let's start with you. What are you thinking about this month?
Speaking of download, I have been binge viewing Mad Men, and it has taken on a life of its own on my
Welcome
Twitter.
Welcome to 2007,
yeah,
AJ.
Yeah, Mad Men came out when I was not very aware of high-quality dramas on television. I was a lot younger, and I'm really enjoying piling through them, but I'm having this moment where I'm live-tweeting me watching Mad Men many years too late, and I'm wondering, when am I going to get to the point where I cannot be live-tweeting certain plot turns because I might be spoiling it for somebody out there who has not watched this. And it brought to mind the idea of, what is the window of time when you can finally tweet about a plot turn? When am I going to be able to openly tweet about the finale of Homeland without somebody freaking the flip out on me? Because since we're in this age of, you know, binge viewing and discovering on Netflix all these wonderful shows, you know, what is this window of time? When can we start talking about TV shows when so many people are discovering them online?
I don't know if any of you tell me who shot JR, you're gonna be pissed. Joe, what are you thinking about?
For me, this month, it's all about a new Fox show called Enlisted. It premiered last week. It is amazing. Let's not say amazing.
No, I love that show.
The show is not necessarily creating a whole new paradigm for TV comedy. What it does is it takes the traditional network comedy and does it really, really well. In case you don't know, it's about three brothers who happen to be in the rare deployment unit of the Army down in Florida. And it's sort of MASH by way of brothers. I just watch this show. It's a sweet family show. It's a show about people taking care of each other. It has the sort of manic sort of vibe to it of The Best of Stripes, for example, back in the 80s. Enlisted is a great show that unfortunately Fox has chosen to bury on Friday nights because they've taken leave of their senses. But while you can, watch Enlisted. You will not regret it.
I agree. Watch Enlisted.
Yeah,
great
show. I think all three of us can agree.
That's an order.
It's a strong show. There you go. You know, the show that really took me at the end of 2013 was Sundance Channel's The Returned. Have you guys seen this yet?
French zombie drama?
It's the zombie drama that's not about zombies.
And it has subtitles.
It has subtitles, but it has creepy kids. It has people returning from the dead. It's a fantastic show, and I've been fascinated by I went online to see what the reaction was to the subtitles. I went to Sundance's Facebook page, and it's funny. The first week that The Return went on the air, there was the debate. I didn't turn the TV on to read it. This America. But by week two, the people who stuck around, like, that's part of the show. That's actually part of the brilliance of watching it as someone who doesn't know French is I don't know necessarily what's going on.
They can say whatever they want.
I mean, obviously, you know because you're reading it, but it's sort of this extra layer of tension because you're a little unsettled because they are speaking to each other in French. But it's got the creepy kid, like I said. It's a fascinating drama. Sundance is doing a lot of interesting stuff. They just renewed it for a second season, or rather, I guess it's been renewed in France. So it will be back for second season, which is good because it ended on an unsettling note. So I'm looking forward to season two. And speaking of things that are coming back, we'll be back next month. So, Joe, we'll see you then. Thanks.
Ciao, Michelle.
And thanks, AJ.
I'll see you guys next month.
That was Joe Adalian, West Coast editor for Vulture.com. He tweets at TV Mojo. And AJ Marischal, who covers television for Variety, and you can follow her on Twitter at Variety_AJM. And I'm Mike Schneider, the LA Bureau Chief for TV Guide Magazine, and my Twitter handle is at Franklin Avenue. And that's it for this edition of The Spinoff, the TV podcast from KCRW's The Business. This episode and all episodes of KCRW's The Business is produced by Darby Maloney. Melissa Morton is our technical director, and today we had production assistance from Will Bentley. You can find this and other episodes of The Business on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. You can also listen to us online at kcrw.com and on demand with the KCRW smartphone app. And that's it for our TV party. We'll see you next month.